This podcast is a production of Open Pediatrics, an open access online community of healthcare professionals sharing best practices from around the world. Visit openpediatrics.org for more.
Hello and welcome to the World Shared Practice Forum. I'm Dr. Tracy Walbrink, a pediatric intensivist at Boston Children's Hospital and co-director of Open Pediatrics. I'm delighted to be joined today by the members of the International Pediatric Sepsis Definition Task Force, led by the Society of Critical Care Medicine, to discuss the development of the criteria in the sepsis score. Dr. Lauren Shutluck is a professor of pediatric intensive care at the University Children's Hospital Zurich. He worked as co-chair of the Pediatric Sepsis Definition Task Force, together with Dr. Scott Watson. His research and clinical interest is understanding why some children become particularly unwell due to infection and other types of inflammation.
Hi, Tracy. Thank you so much for welcoming us here. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Also joined today by Dr. Scott Watson, who's a professor of pediatrics at the University of Washington School of Medicine and associate division chief of pediatric critical care medicine at Seattle Children's Hospital. He was also a co-chair of the task force, along with Dr. Schlottbach.
Hi, Tracy. Thanks so much for having us here.
And Dr. Claudio Oliveira is a pediatric critical care specialist from São Paulo, Brazil, and is a member and researcher at the Latin American Institute of Sepsis.
Hi. Hello, Tracy. It's a pleasure for me to be here.
Dr. Halden Scott is an associate professor of pediatrics at the University of Colorado School of Medicine and a pediatric emergency medicine physician at Children's Hospital of Colorado. She is focused on improving diagnosis, early resuscitation, and systems of emergency care to improve outcomes in pediatric sepsis.
Thank you for having me here today.
And Dr. Tel Bennett is professor of biomedical informatics and pediatrics, critical care medicine at the University of Colorado, and an attending physician in the pediatric ICU at Children's Hospital Colorado. His research concentrations are in critical care decision-making, predictive analytics, electronic health record data, and clinical decision support tools.
Hi, Tracy. Great to be here.
Well, thank you all. I'm very excited to speak with you today to discuss your recent papers that were published in JAMA in January of 2024, entitled The International Consensus Criteria for Pediatric Sepsis and Septic Shock, and Development and Validation of the Phoenix Criteria for Pediatric Sepsis and Septic Shock. So welcome, everyone. All right, if we could just start out, Lauren, could you tell us a little bit about why it was important to form the task force? Why was SECM interested in bringing this task force together?
Well, as pediatricians, I think we've all been exposed to during our training and daily work that sepsis is one of the leading causes actually of childhood mortality and morbidity. And we experience too often actually children that develop long-term consequences after it. The latest assessment of burden based on the Global Burden of Disease study indicates that there's about 25 million cases, so almost half of worldwide sepsis cases that affect pediatric age groups, leading to about 3 million deaths. However, we've struggled actually for many years or decades actually with how to characterize that disease. As we know, it is sepsis is to a degree a heterogeneous disease that can affect very different types of patients. But the last attempt actually to really define criteria for sepsis in children date back to 2005. And back then, there was a group formed for the International Pediatric Sepsis Consensus Conference, you know, which essentially came together and put together evidence-based criteria to allow the inclusion of children in a trial. And these criteria have been used to a degree since then, but variably so, and substantial confusion actually has persisted around actually what should be called sepsis. In adults, the field has dramatically changed in 2016 when the Adult Sepsis 3 Task Force released revised criteria for sepsis, now labeled Sepsis 3. Sepsis 3 defines sepsis as dysregulated host response to infection leading to organ dysfunction. But how they actually characterize sepsis using clinically applicable criteria was they derived measures of organ dysfunction that they validate in very large international data sets. However, most of these data actually came from the US with a predominance as well, you know, with many ICU patients. And the score used actually to develop this was an adult score, the SOFA score, which actually had not been validated in children. Despite sort of the many advantages that sepsis 3 brought, pediatric field essentially has experienced a gap since then, you know, with a widening discrepancy between the, let's call it sort of old pediatric criteria, and sepsis 3 for adults, which actually had explicitly excluded children. And given the burden of sepsis, this was sort of the reason why in 2017 and 18, we got together with a number of researchers and clinicians to discuss actually how a strategy should be defined to tackle this.
Fantastic. Thank you. I think this is a really exciting task force that was convened and such an important clinical concept to update. And I'm curious how this task force was developed, who was invited to be members of the task force to make sure it's as globally applicable as possible. And Dr. Watson, I wonder if you wouldn't mind filling us in a little bit about how the task force members were chosen.
Yeah, of course. I'd be happy to. The SCCM supportive task force, after efforts by a number of people, including Jerry Zimmerman and Tex Kassoon, to obtain their support, and SCCM appointed two co-chairs and then two co-vice chairs to lead the group. We got together, we started in 2018 and met with SCCM, with Jerry and Tex, and then also with the leaders of Sepsis 3 to get some insights from their approach. It was key to us to have a diverse task force in terms of not just gender and healthcare setting, but also discipline. So we sought to reach out individuals with expertise in global health, in pediatric emergency medicine, infectious diseases, public health, and then also with scientific expertise in quality improvement, clinical trials, epidemiology, and informatics to develop as much as possible criteria that would be globally relevant across a range of healthcare settings and environments. Once we agreed on the general concept of what we were going for, then we started to reach out to experts across the world and invite them to participate. And we're fortunate that 35 agreed to volunteer their time and expertise to the effort.
It's fantastic. And I, you know, really appreciate that you reached out to all the different resource settings, as well as different care providers that might be managing children with sepsis. And you created a really, I think, large amount of work for your task force in terms of the three phases that you intended to sort of work through, beginning with your survey, followed up with your literature review and meta-analysis, and then the validation. And I wonder if you could talk with us a little bit just about those three rough phases, and we can dive in a little bit deeper. But if you don't mind just giving a little bit of a brief overview.
Of course. As Lauren mentioned, the 2005 criteria were developed, and most criteria at the time were developed just strictly based on consensus or eminence-based criteria. And it was clear to us, and also, of course, from Sepsis 3, that a better way to do this would be a data-based approach. So really letting actual evidence guide us. Now, to optimally plan the analyses, we wanted to do a needs assessment, so a global survey to understand what clinicians and also researchers wanted in sepsis criteria and what resources they had available. And then, of course, what had been published in the literature regarding what may or may not work for sepsis criteria. And then those efforts informed the data analysis and validation.
If I might ask you, how did this differ from what was done for the Sepsis 3 criteria in 2016? What lessons learned from that and anything that you decided would be really important for these criteria?
We had the advantage that we could learn from Sepsis 3, right? And I think the first key aspect that Scott already alluded to was that we wanted to make sure that we had a diverse task force in terms of geographical origin, gender, discipline, expertise. And that proved invaluable actually throughout, you know, the whole work of this team. You know, it's become a team with a lot of friends, you know, throughout that work over the past few years. I think a second difference, which is something that certainly, you know, Tel will comment on much more in detail, was actually the breadth of the databases accessed and the diversity of healthcare settings now used to it. And the third difference, I think, you know, relates to the needs assessment, because after Sepsis 3, there were some questions that, you know, to what degree is this useful in any type of setting? Is it more focused on high-income settings? How is it applicable to settings which maybe use less resources, for example, you know, ED settings, which use less lab tests, for example, and, you know, what are the implications, for example, for quality improvement as well. And when we did the needs assessment, we surveyed 2,833 clinicians, mostly pediatricians, pediatric intensivists, ED physicians around the world, actually with the predominance actually coming from Asia and South America. And we asked them a number of key questions. So first question I can watch was, which diagnostic and therapeutic resources do you have? And it was quite interesting to see that some more complicated lab tests actually were not widely available. Even expertise of certain specialist areas was not available broadly. And this meant as well that something such as lactate, for example, seems quite suitable as the most commonly used point of care test. But we need to be aware that even something like lactate is not available fully all around the world. The second question we asked in the needs assessment, actually, what they perceived as the usefulness of current criteria for sepsis and septic shock. And we asked both around IPSCC criteria as well as about the WHO criteria as well about sepsis 3. And we asked them, you know, which types of features make you think that a patient has sepsis? And so it emerged as well from how clinicians responded that they did not express sort of a strong feeling that the currently available criteria were very useful. But in their daily practice, when they were asked to say, which children do you consider as septic or as in septic shock, features of organ dysfunction actually were predominant. You know, features of cardiovascular compromise were obviously dominant, you know, for septic shock. And when we then asked them actually to state actually which type of patient groups would they rank highest in terms of actually what they consider as sepsis. What was considered not as sepsis was a child that has some type of infection without organ dysfunction. So supporting that the pure presence of systemic inflammatory response syndrome, you know, which based on the old sepsis criteria, essentially would merit, you know, the label sepsis, it did not seem that this is what actually most clinicians actually would call sepsis. So it became obvious that although sepsis 3 had only been published in adults, that for pediatric clinicians around the world, the presence of organ dysfunction was associated actually with a very strong perception that this was sepsis. And a slightly even stronger perception that something was sepsis if the organ dysfunction actually occurred remote from the primary site of infection. Then, so for example, a child with severe pneumonia that develops not only respiratory failure, but as well goes in shock, you know, as an example. So shock and, you know, that type of organ dysfunction were considered strong indicators of sepsis, but any infection with associated organ dysfunction. So this gave a good sense of sort of the acceptability of current concepts. And then the last question was actually, what do you expect from a future definition or from future criteria for sepsis in children? And interestingly, maybe not surprising, but essentially the expectation was that new criteria do everything. And so they should be specific, they should allow prognostication, they should identify a subgroup of higher mortality. But in particular, you know, they should not only assist research and quality improvement, but they should facilitate as well early recognition to facilitate early treatment. And I think this essentially gave us a very good layout of the land of what we had to do. And hopefully in the next half an hour, we can discuss a bit the things we have done and the things that are yet, you know, to be done.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for diving in and telling us a bit about the survey that was conducted and wondering kind of moving into the second phase. Dr. Scott, I wonder if you might talk with us a little bit about what you learned and how you conducted the literature review meta-analysis portion of your task force.
Absolutely. So this was work by the task force, and it was led by Kusum Menon and Lauren Source, who led the systematic review. There were really a few goals with this to understand what is known about identifying sepsis in children, what seems to work, what predictors are readily available and used, all coming from the published literature as a complement to what people said in the survey. There were two main focuses. One was to identify variables that were associated with the development of sepsis, severe sepsis, and septic shock, so that kind of early recognition phase. And the second goal was to identify variables associated with multiple organ dysfunction or death in children with sepsis. So a systematic review was conducted looking at literature between 2004 and 2020 with pre-specified inclusion and exclusion criteria for the quality of studies, which resulted in of a database search that initially produced 12,000 papers, resulted in really 81 papers that met pre-specified inclusion criteria for this meta-analysis. All of the papers were classified by settings, so we could see were there vast differences in how different criteria performed or were available in different income settings. And it turned out, though the inclusion criteria were inclusive, ultimately only 18 studies and 1.8% of the patients came from lower middle income countries. And most of the included patients and studies also came from the ICU setting. So that was sort of the state of the world literature on these questions going into this, not a desired outcome. And unfortunately, it also identified that the areas where the mortality was highest, as has been previously described, are these lower income settings where we had the least data. So this was something we wanted to address in the future steps of the work. Looking to the question of what predicted sepsis, there were unfortunately so few articles that met the inclusion criteria for this question of what predicted severe sepsis in children with infection that a true meta-analysis couldn't be performed. There was just sort of a qualitative gathering of data and predictors, identifying decreased level of consciousness as a predictor of sepsis, as well as a PRISM score. So the bulk of the meta-analysis was conducted in identifying values or variables that were associated with organ dysfunction and death among children with sepsis. And for this, really, organ dysfunction scores and concepts came out as predictive of poor outcome, as well as demographic variables like chronic conditions or malnutrition. So in the end, whichever way it was described, whether it was a specific score like a PLOD score or a PRISM score or the number of organ systems that were dysfunctional, all of these were associated, not surprisingly, with mortality. While that's not a surprising finding, it was important to do in the systematic way where we looked at children with infection across the world, across settings, and found that these concepts still held as predictors of mortality, and also kind of highlighted the relative paucity of world literature focused on the lower income settings where children are most at risk for poor outcomes. And that led us to the next phases.
Well, thank you. And in addition to noticing sort of the paucity of literature in the low and middle income countries, was there anything else that surprised you in your meta-analysis that you all as a task force agree that you must make sure that you included in your new consensus and or validation of your sepsis score? Was there anything in particular that you paid a lot of attention to or really focused on based on what you saw in the literature?
I think it wasn't surprising as much as confirming that our survey data was sort of on the right track, that this concept of organ dysfunction was important.
And I think as Dr. Scott mentioned, that the survey and systematic review provided us with a very important group of subpopulations that we needed to formally test in the analytic part of the work to make sure that the new criteria would function well in those groups, like children with comorbidities and things like that.
And that sort of brings us, I guess, to the validation and development of the sepsis score. And I wonder, Dr. Bennett, if you might talk us through a little bit of that.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So it's very important from early on in the task force conversations that the new criteria be developed and validated using data from all of the environments in which they might be applied in the future. This meant that we would need to put together a data set that didn't exist where electronic health record data from all over the world, particularly both high and low resource environments, could be integrated. And so our colleague, Nelson Sanchez Pinto at Lurie Children's Hospital, and I led the writing of an NIHR-1, which was ultimately funded to support obtaining data from 6 US sites and then 4 sites around the world from Colombia, Bangladesh, China, and Kenya in order to have that richness of data. And importantly, those data extractions from all the sites included pediatric encounters from the emergency department, from the inpatient floor, and from the intensive care unit, so that we had representation across sort of the entire spectrum of pediatric care for those children who need it. We then developed a really careful and robust data harmonization process and a reproducible pipeline for curating the variables necessary. And then knowing that this concept of organ dysfunction was going to underlie the work going forward, in the first step of the process, we took a fairly complete set of existing organ dysfunction scores and broke them apart into their components. So all of the cardiovascular components, all of the respiratory components, because this had not been done previously, and identified which one worked best, basically, for each organ system. We then took the best performing ones and put them back together into some machine learning models using an ensemble approach or stacking approach, and engaged with the task force about the ability of those machine learning models to predict mortality. Again, that concept of sepsis being life-threatening organ dysfunction in the context of suspected or proven infection. And that was one of the interesting and important junctions in the process where there were equivalently performing models, one of which had 4 and one of which had 8 organ systems. And ultimately, the task force in the interest of pragmatism and applicability to lower resource environments, chose the four organ system model to move forward in the process so that practitioners at the bedside would not need to obtain as many tests in order to diagnose children with sepsis. From those models, we then reduced sort of fancy math to integer sets of criteria and made sure that we didn't lose performance in that process. And then engaged with the task force again about thresholds of those integer criteria where there would be a kind of binary yes, no, above this, you have sepsis, below this, you don't. And correspondingly, how we would define septic shock in that same framework.
Yeah, to those of us that don't spend a lot of time in machine learning and these large database models, I wonder if you could speak a little bit as to, you know, the difference between the 4-item and 8-item scale and how different you think these are. It seems like the 4-item score performed very well, but I'm wondering, you know, were there comments and what were some of the major discussions that you had as you sort of decided which one to go with and whether or not this one was going to be well enough performing to release?
Great question. And this was something that we spent quite a lot of time on as a group. And, you know, at the machine learning model level, they performed roughly equivalently in terms of, again, predicting mortality under that construct of life-threatening organ dysfunction. And I do think it was the simplicity of the four organ systems that kind of won the day in the end, carrying it forward. But I think there were several organ systems that are known to be quite important in the clinical care of patients with sepsis. And so we needed to be very clear when we disseminated the work that we are not indicating that the four organ systems that were in the 8, but not in the 4, were not important, you know, to evaluate and address and support in the care of children with sepsis, but rather that you didn't need to evaluate them formally in order to make the diagnosis. And this was, I think, something that was a little bit challenging for folks at first because they were used to evaluating these organ systems in order to make the diagnosis under the old framework. But I think that we've had conversations with them in the couple of months since then. I think they kind of understood the pragmatism that was underneath the decision.
And if you don't mind, one more question related to the scoring system. In the article, you mentioned excluding preterm neonates. And I'm curious if there were any other special populations that you either excluded or you felt like this model wouldn't serve very well. You know, in particular, I'm thinking about stem cell transplant patients or others that might be special populations. And if you have any advice or recommendations for those kinds of special populations.
Yeah, so the only exclusions were by age, so 18 years or older, below 37 weeks post-conceptual age. And or still in their birth hospitalization. And we did that in collaboration with neonatology members of the task force in order to not have collision between neonatal sepsis criteria and these. But other than that, we did not exclude any subgroups. And in fact, in the papers have evaluated performance of the score and the new criteria in a wide variety of subgroups. And overall, it's performed well in most or all of them. And we have active collaborations with a number of representatives of specific subgroups to sort of double check that going forward.
So I guess this kind of brings the question of what do you think this means for clinicians? And how do you recommend that clinicians apply this score in clinical practice?
So I think the first point is these criteria, based on the best available knowledge, the largest data sets to date analyzed in children, are very robust to identify children with infection or suspected infection that have high risk of mortality. And as such, actually, they should be used to define sepsis, you know, to classify sepsis or, you know, to post hoc analyze actually how many patients had sepsis, for example. So the purpose really now should really help standardized, harmonized assessment actually of the burden of disease, be very useful for research and highly comparable as well, because Tell and team have shown very nicely that the performance of these criteria is high across a multitude of healthcare settings. However, and I think that's really important to realize, and Holden now may comment more in detail on this, these criteria are not there to guide what we should do at the bedside, right? Because there may be children with a viral infection that meet some of the criteria who actually may not necessarily even need antibiotics. And the criteria certainly were designed actually to be highly performant, in particular in relation to the specificity in prediction of mortality. But this does not mean that they allow us to recognize early who will develop sepsis. And I'm keen to hear some of the comments from our colleagues from the task force.
Yeah, and I wonder, Dr. Oliveira, if you could comment on how this criteria could be used in differently resourced settings.
Yes. So this is a very good point, because throughout the entire work, there was this concern coming with criteria that could be used in most or all of the places. And I was very happy to see when we could reach a criteria that could be both used for high resource places and low resource places. That was a very good point to start. But still, there are some adaptations that probably are going to be needed in some places, because even when we restrict it to 4 organ or 4 system model, there are still some places or many places where we don't have all the tests or all the conditions to completely analyze all the potential points to insert in the score. We were having a discussion this last weekend with doctors from Latin America, and it was a very nice discussion because people are already trying to put the score into the practice, into the everyday life. And so they were discussing, okay, I don't have lactate, so what can I do instead to have some kind of approximation? I don't have equipment that calculates the mean arterial pressure. So, okay, how can I work with that? I don't have vasoactive at my disposal, at my service. So how can I survive with that without taking that potential point into account? I think this is going to be really interesting to see. And of course, there is this huge work of validation that's going to be necessary, especially for countries like my country and African countries, Asian countries. In other words, there is some work that is just starting. So how we can translate into the practice of our practitioners this knowledge of the sepsis score.
And building on that, you obviously have so much insight into lots of the discussions that were had, choices that you made for this score. What advice would you have for groups that are interested in studying this and doing further analyses of these across the resource setting? Where are the areas that you would recommend that people start and focus and try to think about how do you do the next phase of research?
Well, I think considering some of these pragmatic adaptations and the variables that we have available to us are really important. As Claudio mentioned, in many settings, we may be measuring blood pressure with a manual cuff, and that mean arterial pressure value isn't there or requires some calculation. And this first phase of research was really working with existing organ dysfunction scores and finding the optimal ones. And another phase that's really important that I think we're all eager to dive into is looking at other measures for the same organ dysfunction, but using the variables that are available to us, like systolic or diastolic blood pressure instead of a mean arterial pressure, for example. Does it perform similarly? Not only is that useful for different income countries, but even different settings within countries, whether it's an emergency department or an ambulance in the pre-hospital setting or transfer setting, which is often necessary. Children with life-threatening organ dysfunction will hopefully eventually end up in a pediatric intensive care unit, but that's not usually where children start, and they have to cover some geographic distance and pretty much anywhere in the world to get to a advanced center. And during that time, often different variables are available to measure and care for that child. I think another direction for research and another clinical consideration for this definition is that this identifies children who are really sick. We wanted that to be sort of the essence of sepsis. The essence of this definition is life-threatening organ dysfunction. It doesn't identify all children who require sepsis treatment. In an ideal state, we are identifying and finding those children and giving them good early resuscitation so they never get so severely ill. So identifying that earlier set of screening criteria, the elements that in the literature review, we couldn't find early on a lot of publications, a lot of variables that were doing this well before these definitions. These definitions have set a good gold standard definition of sepsis for us to work for and look for. And now another phase of research will be finding criteria that help us find those patients before they get that ill.
I'm wondering, you know, we've sort of been talking a little bit about some of the challenges and limitations and things for future study. I'm curious if there were any other major components that came up in addition to like resource limitations that were either heavily debated that, you know, you would like to illuminate or things here that we should know a little bit more about the discussions that were happening in the room. I thought it was really nice to see the supplement and see a lot of the conversations that were had in the paper, but I'm curious if you might distill those a little bit. You know, what other things were you guys discussing or kind of debating about?
Yes, you're right. There was some controversies, and I would say that, well, maybe my colleagues can help me afterwards, but I would start with two points. One of them, Tel has already mentioned, that was the 8 versus 4 organs model. It was very interesting discussion, and I guess we came up with, and here I would speak for the doctors from my region, as we had very similar results between 4 and 8 model systems, it's very good to have a result that is much more simple, much more easy to use in our practice. But I cannot deny it. It was a very, very intense discussion around that. And even around the data, although the data were really clear, I guess we ended up with a very nice solution. And I remember there was another very interesting discussion around whether sepsis should be related to a local organ dysfunction or a system or a remote or only remote organ dysfunction. It's very interesting because all the concept of sepsis is around a systemic process. But as everybody can see, we have a score that, for example, a patient with a respiratory infection can have sepsis with only one organ's function. But again, I think that result was really based on data and really based on the potential risks for the children. And I guess we had the best result afterwards.
And I wonder if there were any other... Dr. Bennett, any other criteria that you sort of considered putting in the model that didn't necessarily make it?
So I think that was one interesting feature of the analytic approach is that, you know, it wasn't us sort of choosing things to try, but rather a pretty well pre-specified approach where we took a complete set of these organ system components and identified which were the best in each category, and then took those best ones forward in a variety of different, again, pre-specified machine learning models. And those algorithms told us which ones worked best. And I do think that while it sounds very computational, it avoided a lot of bias that can interject itself into other kind of analytic decision-making. And so the pairing of that process with kind of the check-ins with the task force on these critical issues, I think, led to the development of robust criteria.
Dr. Scott, if you wouldn't mind just letting everyone know where the term Phoenix came from and why these are called the Phoenix guidelines.
Well, they were announced in Phoenix, Arizona. So that was a convenient source of a name for the definition, but the task force really liked this name because, of course, the phoenix is a mythologic creature associated with rebirth. And that's our goal here, really, is to take a condition that is headed towards a life-threatening outcome and reinvigorate, to use the French call their ICUs, reanimation, to reanimate, to rebirth, to save the lives of children. And that was all sort of encompassed in Phoenix.
And I'm wondering, before we close down, does anybody else have anything that we haven't necessarily covered that you think would be an important question to address here?
I guess there is probably you're going to ask that on the limitation. And Luden has already mentioned, but people are asking a lot about screening tools. And I'm just saying, because we had this webinar with the Latin American doctors, and half of the questions were about screening tools.
I guess the only thing I would add is, and I'm quite enthusiastic about the work that Claudio and Halden are talking about identifying whether sort of variants of the inputs can perform as well in other environments. There is quite a bit of redundancy built into the score. So there are many ways to get 2 points. And I think that one of the reasons that the score and the criteria perform so well in our analysis in the lower resource environments is that there were many ways for those children to get to 2 points and be diagnosed with sepsis, even if those institutions either did not perform a test or did not record what they did in a way that it was accessible to us. And so I think, you know, we're in an okay place starting out with these criteria while we sort out the environment-specific variation.
One question we get as people are asking about screening criteria is it okay to use these Phoenix criteria now in clinical use and quality improvement? And my answer is yes. I mean, we heard from organizations that were building these criteria into their electronic health record or quality improvement dashboards within 24 hours of them being released. And I think while it's good and we want to find children earlier than meeting these criteria, having ways of identifying children who meet the Phoenix criteria when it happens is a really helpful safety backstop that is useful and improves quality and safety to have in the electronic health record or other screening systems. Children who meet these criteria are really sick. We'd like to find them sooner, but I'd also like to know that my healthcare system could help me find them if I miss them before that fact, and that it's being brought to the attention of clinicians throughout the system. So they're certainly ready to use, even if we're striving to find children sooner.
Fantastic. Thank you. And I'm wondering if some of our listeners may not have actually read the article yet. And I'm wondering if one of you may be able to do just a quick 30 to 60 second summary of how to use these criteria. What are the components that are in there? And, you know, the scoring.
So there are the four organ systems in there: cardiovascular, respiratory, neurologic, and coagulation. And the cardiovascular components are mostly blood pressure and lactate. The respiratory components are mostly some measure of oxygenation, as well as what support the child is on in terms of oxygen and whether they're ventilated. There are four lab tests in the coagulation category. Again, you don't necessarily need to do them all because of that redundancy we were talking about a couple of minutes ago. And then pupils and Glasgow Coma Scale score are the neurologic inputs. So that's kind of the complete set, and how to weight them into the scores in the main tables of each paper.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much. And I just want to thank you all on behalf of the task force. And I think it's just incredible to see what you've accomplished and how you put together an incredible group of worldwide experts across high, low, middle income countries, all resource settings, to really come together to think about a simple system that can be used in so many ways, specifically for potentially some early scales to identify these patients early and in research. And I think it's going to be really exciting to see what future derivation and other studies come out of here to sort of look at, as all of you have been describing, different ways to kind of address the same parts on the score if you don't have the resources that are listed here.
Maybe it's just worth saying that this was a real teamwork over, you know, several years, with an absolutely immense dedication from people from all around the world, dedicating a lot of their free time, a lot of their professional time, and an absolutely massive, massive amount of work from the data team led by, you know, Tella Nelson, which I think reading the data paper from, you know, from Santos Pinto et al., one gets a sense of what they did. But I still think this is just the tip of the iceberg, actually, of what's in the paper there. So, you know, huge thanks to the data team as well for doing that.
Again, I just thank you all for your involvement in this task force over the years. I think this is just such an important contribution to our field. And I thank you also for being here to share your work with the whole community. So thank you.
This has been a production of Open Pediatrics. You can find the resources and journal articles referenced in this podcast in the description. We have more podcasts like this one available everywhere you get your podcasts. Visit openpediatrics.org for more information.